The following presentation is from North Pine Baptist Church. We trust that it will help you learn more about God and His message for the world. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.
Men can give birth, and you bet it ticked off the transphobes. In a cover designed by illustrator Lauren Rebeck for his 24th volume in May, The Practicing Midwife emphatically said that trans men who give birth are amazing. Part of the magazine's normal birth series, the cover features a trans black man, so it's ticking all the boxes, after giving birth to a baby as his partner looks on in pride. His fist raised in the air, showing a rainbow tattoo with the words "Right On" underneath. Of course, because of their hobby is hate, says Fit News, the cover quickly became the target of transphobic Twitter trolls and anti-trans pressure groups. So, again, this sort of highlights another end, perhaps a more extreme end of the situation where men are now having babies. This evening, I want to sort of explore some of the stuff that's kind of led to that position, this attempt to normalise things that are perhaps not quite so normal. And so we're going to work through a few things. We're going to try to work through what it is to be woke, what that actually means for those who may be unfamiliar with the term. What has led to that, in particular looking at just a little bit of postmodernism and also critical theory, and then try to ask the question and perhaps try to answer it. That is the question being, you know, what do we as Christians do about all this? How should we respond? Show of hands here, how many people are familiar now with the term woke? Become more and more familiar? So I won't need to say a huge amount, but I'll just mention a couple of things. First of all, it has a longer history than we perhaps realise. It has its origins in the early 20th century as a kind of a call for black people around the world to become more socially and politically aware. Just by way of example, Marcus Garvey, who is a Jamaican philosopher and social activist, issued a call to wake up Ethiopia and wake up Africa in 1923, which was the year Ethiopia joined the League of Nations. In 1938, blues singer Huddy Leadbetter, and I'm guessing a few people would probably be familiar with him, he was known as Leadbelly, so Alan's a great fan, because it's 1938, so he was just a teenager then. I may say that because Ted's not here. So, but he warned his listeners to stay woke when travelling in Scottsboro, Arkansas. He said this in the context of having met the young African-American men falsely accused of raping two white women aboard a train in Scottsboro in 1931. That trial went on forever, and it was eventually they were all exonerated as a beggar. Over the ensuing decades, the word was used within black communities as a word of caution. It was a word linked to an awareness of racial injustice. And then in 2014, it became more widely known because of its use by the Black Lives Matter protests when the term was used as a hashtag, so hashtag stay woke, in social media posts and on posters when African Americans took to the streets of Ferguson in St. Louis in protest over the shooting of an unarmed African-American, an 18-year-old lad, the name of Michael Brown, by a white police officer, Darren Wilson. It became then the kind of cautionary watchword of Black Lives Matter activists on the streets, and was used as a warning to keep watch for police brutality and unjust police tactics. It's also used as a title of a 2016 documentary, which is called Stay Woke, the Black Lives Matter Movement. But then, up to that point, it's kind of almost exclusively used by black communities and by Black Lives Matter movement. But then in 2017, it began to be used by other groups. Some of the protesters taking part in the first of the women's marches held on January 21st, 2017, carried posters and placards bearing that term. It showed that the use of the word itself and the embracing of the idea of wokeness had broadened and was being applied beyond its original use within the black community. According to the mission statement on the Women's March website, it says this, and this is kind of the broader embracing of this thing. The rhetoric of the past election cycle, referring to Trump's election, has insulted, demonised and threatened many of us. Immigrants of all statuses, Muslims and those of diverse religious faiths, people who identify as LGBTQIA, native people, black and brown people, people with disabilities, survivors of sexual assault, and our communities are hurting and scared. We are confronted with the question of how to move forward in the face of national and international concern and fear. And so by that point, things have broadened considerably. It includes every minority or marginalised group in existence. And it's that broadened application that we're probably familiar with today. So it had a particular application early and now has broadened considerably. So what does it mean? An American writer, Chloe Valdery, who runs a company called Theory of Enchantment, what a nice name, says, "My sense is that by woke, what people mean is a new form of being enlightened, repackaged for our modern era. The Enlightenment, The Enlightenment was meant to be an era of new progressive ideas, and folks fancy themselves awakened by new ideas and knowledge. Similarly, people today who identify as woke also see themselves as having been awakened to a new set of ideas, value systems, knowledge. The mode and the values are different, but the sensibility, the idea that previously you were blind and now you can see, is the same. And then Jamar Tisby, who's the president of The Witness, a black Christian collective, is also a member of the Gospel Coalition, made this observation. Just bring that up on the screen. He said, if you really delve into the metaphor of being awoke, it implies that in some sense you're asleep to particular kinds of injustices and oppressions in the world, and now you have been awakened to it. So this broader sense of being woke is grounded in postmodernism and in critical theory, and those are what we're going to turn our attention to now. I'm going to abbreviate things considerably, just because if I don't, I'll speak for way too long. And as much as you'd enjoy that, you do want to get home at the right time. And we always promise to be finished within the hour, including question time, so we'll stick to that. So, postmodernism, first of all, is a particular way of thinking about the world and our place in the world. It's really a world view as well as a philosophical position that has been pretty well evident and practiced or understood perhaps probably from about the 1960s. Prior to that, most people who didn't have any particular religious belief might have been called modernists, people who believed that knowledge was an objective reality, that it could be discovered. That morality was actually real and could be found, you know, found and acted upon. Things of that sort. Believed in the idea that humanity could progress and through technological advancement and so on could actually kind of tame the world and control it. So those kinds of things. Postmodernists came along and said, you've got to be kidding. We've just had a couple of wars. World War I, World War II, and more since. Things aren't working out quite the way you guys claimed. And so they called modernism into question. So there's a sense in which postmodernism is a questioning of or a critique of modernism. There are probably three guys who are the main founders of postmodernist thought. There's Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault, and Jean-François Lyotard. Again, their writings are lengthy and terribly complex. So I won't try to read any of that to you or quote anything directly from them except for a few snippets, because it would just take too long and take too much to explain. But Jacques Derrida is probably the founder of, in some ways, postmodernism itself. He's the founder of deconstructionism as a way of sort of interrogating a text. He's famous for kind of coining the idea that there is nothing outside the text. Now, what that effectively means is that when you have something written before you, or any other kind of text, it could be a visual text like a film or a picture or a sign, anything. Once you've got that, that's all you've got. And you must interpret it. You need to deconstruct it and from it draw meaning. If the author of that text says this means such and such, you can ignore that. Authority is an irrelevance. All you have is the text. Now, as you can guess, what that really means is, in the practical outworking of it, is that whenever you engage with a text, you engage, you bring all your own personal baggage to it, your own history and everything else, and you make a meaning from the text. So you do it, I do it. That means for every person here, we make a slightly different meaning. Therefore, there is no objective or set meaning for any text. Now, you can see where that would take us if we applied that to our understanding of the Bible. What the Bible is intended to convey is now not, it's not able to convey, so people can read it through other lenses. So you now have things like feminist readings of the Bible, you have black readings of the Bible, and so on and so forth. Now you can have gay readings of the Bible, because the Bible has no inherent authority in itself as truth. The thing that has truth is the perspective from which you read it. So that becomes the most important thing. Michel Foucault was one who understood every text to include notions of power. There was always a power imbalance. There was a group that, or a body that had power and another group that didn't. So there were those who oppressed and those who were the oppressors. And when you engage in the text, you need to look for the power balances and the power imbalances within the text. And he also was one who understood changing meanings of terms, but he was also another who understood sexuality as being on a spectrum. He rejected the idea of binaries. And so from that he determined, he wrote a multi-body work on this, from that he determined that all sexual expressions, all expressions of sexuality were equally valid. If you try to impose another type of sexuality or sexual expression on other people, you were an oppressor. So if you claimed heteronormativity, if you were claimed binaries, you know, male, female, and that sort of thing, you were an oppressor. So he worked on that sort of idea, the idea that every expression of gender or sexual preference was equally legitimate. Jean-Francois Lyotard, he actually defined postmodernism, particularly, in some ways, he really was the one who got the term accepted as a term, but he talked about it as incredulity towards meta-narratives. Now, a meta-narrative is a big story which encompasses all other stories. So, as Christians, we have the Christian meta-narrative, that is the story of God's redemptive purpose. Now, human beings were created good, but sinned. And then the rest of the story is about God's plan of redemption, culminating in the work of Christ on the cross, and ultimately in judgment and our elevation to glory. So we have a meta-narrative. What Lyotard said, there are no meta-narratives, they don't count. So what you instead have are these little tiny stories. You have isolated narratives, the narrative of that community, a narrative of that community, a narrative of that community. So you could have a narrative of a black community, or the narrative of the gay community, or the narrative of the trans community. And all of those have their own narratives, their own stories, and they're legitimate for that community. And within then the context of that community, they then create meaning. So meaning is then socially constructed by that community, rather than by anything else. Now that in a way kind of sums up the basic tenets of postmodernism. I was going to go into a little bit further, but I won't, just because it will take way too much time to do so. But you can see basically where we're at, that we have texts that can be interpreted in a multiplicity of ways. There is no sense of objective or absolute truth in that. We have a spectrum of sexuality and sexual expression, all of which are equally valid. And we have a rejection of meta-narratives and the installation of smaller narratives. Now, ultimately, that kind of collapses. And as you can probably guess, as the next couple of decades moved on, people started to see that this had no real substance. The idea of a rejection of meta-narratives gave people no meaning. It left people with lives of meaninglessness. Absurdist playwrights who sort of indicated that. Things like Waiting for Godot, you might be familiar with, where a few fellows stand around and they spend the whole play going, "Is Godot here? We're waiting for Godot. Godot here? Where's Godot?" And of course, Godot never arrives. And what they're really suggesting is there's no meaning, there's no purpose. He's hanging around for no particular reason. Now, that, of course, is so bankrupt that ultimately people create meaning. So people become meaning makers. And postmodernism left people open to do that, which meant there was a yawning gap in the whole thing. So what do you start to do with that? Well, it starts to adapt. And it starts to be added to, it starts to modify. And so a fellow by the name of Walter Truett Anderson, he argued there were four principal pillars of postmodernism. I'll just mention two that are, the most pertinent. The first one, he says, is that there is this social construction of the concept of self. So identity is constructed by a range of cultural forces. There is no set idea of a personal identity. So we don't sit around saying we are essentially human. Instead, what we might say is, "I am black." So you don't say, "I am a person who happens to be black." You have to say, "I am black." Now, that, of course, flies in the face of the work of people like Martin Luther King, who was arguing for the equality of all humanity. You know, one day, little black boys and little black girls will play with little white girls and little white boys. There's an essential notion of humanity in that. Some people happen to be black, some people happen to be white, but we're all human together. This view says, no, we're not that. I am black. I'm not a person who happens to be black, I just am. The other part of it is that there is the relativism of moral and ethical discourse. So morality is no longer discovered or delivered, if you like, from on high, but it is made. So all forms of morality then are socially constructed. So we have that issue also. So you can see just in that little slide there, that kind of the gobbledygook at the end kind of represents postmodernism. But you know, pre-modern, God's there, that's the way it is. Modern, onwards and upwards, an inevitable progress. Obviously it's a bit of a quip, and then a whole lot of letters and a bunch of scribble. Postmodernism makes a whole lot of sense. Now I thought that we might do a little exercise. Now I know most of us have to be socially distanced, but you know, a bit of audience participation here. So here's your audience participation question. Now I'm going to skip through all that and go to that. So your group exercise is this. In 1829, the British rulers of India, you know, the British Raj, outlawed the practice of widow burning, known as suki or sati. Were they right to do so? Were they right to do so? So they did that in 1829. Should they have done that? Were they right? So your job is just have a chat with your elbow partner, some of the school teacher thing coming in here, or someone who's really close enough to chat to, and see if you can address that question. And if they were right to do so, why? If they weren't, why not? So I'll give you just a really short time, maybe a minute or two. So go for it. For those listening on the podcast, people are now chatting amongst themselves. However, they're maintaining social distance. So, if in your discussion you concluded that it was the right thing to do to stop widows being burned when their husbands had died, you know, throwing themselves on the funeral pyre, that kind of thing, if you thought that was the right thing to do, you're a colonial imperialist, and you have imposed your particular view on another. You don't fit the postmodern agenda at all. Because you have actually said, I'm a superior being, I know better than you, and I can impose my view upon you. So you have become the oppressor. In fact, in the name of doing something right, you have actually adopted an oppressive pose. So you're looking as though you're trying to be nice, but what you're actually doing is oppressing. So by actually arguing to not have widows burned, you're an oppressor. Now, there's obviously some problems with the logic of it all, because you might also argue for women's rights. But the argument would be that as a good Hindu woman, you would choose to throw yourself on the funeral pyre. So you have the right to do that. If you said it was a cultural cultural practice, and you affirmed that cultural practice, you'd be on the side of postmodernism, because you sided with the minority and the marginalised against the power group. So it's an interesting kind of awkwardness. Interesting, when that did happen back in 1829, it was actually brought about by pressure imposed upon the British government by the wives of Christians, particularly Christian missionaries, back in the home country, back in England. And they pressured them sufficiently for them to say, maybe we should do something about this, and so actually passed a law to stop it. Now, while the main tenets of postmodernism have not undergone really major changes, it has morphed into the many-headed hydra of activism that we are experiencing today. It's moved out of the rarefied halls of academia into mainstream discourse. Many of us have become familiar with various movements, one of them being Black Lives Matter. We're familiar with terms like cancel culture and LGBTQ. They become kind of part of everyday speech and everyday life, and they represent a particularly strident activism. Terms like woke intersectionality, social justice with a capital S and a capital J, have come to be known well. TERF, T-E-R-F, trans exclusionary radical feminists. That is, those feminists who don't like the trans sort of approach. They don't recognise trans women. Identity politics, cisgender. Cisgender. That's a person whose sense of their personal identity and gender actually matches their sex at birth. Critical race theory, queer theory. Queer theory rejects binaries as a means of determining identity and sees the dominant norms as oppressive. All of those are just becoming commonplace terms, even though we may not understand all of them. And this has occurred with some pretty heavy-duty support and advocacy. You know, Hollywood, the entertainment industry, right on board. Many parts of mainstream media, including the ABC, have sought to normalise this worldview and its various outworkings. Big tech, like, you know, the Silicon Valley, has used its enormous power to manipulate social media and other parts of the internet. Even governments, sporting bodies, major corporations have hopped on board. We come across examples of it every day, and you probably know them as well as I do, if not better. For instance, I'll just give a couple of examples to illustrate the point. There's a contentious issue that's come to the fore in, you know, really recent times with regard to the inclusion of trans women in women's sport. However, according to Time magazine, the online version most recently, more than 120, interesting I say more than 120, it's actually 121, I don't know why they said more than 120, but anyway, more than 120 out lesbians, so those people have admitted to it, more than 120 out lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer and non-binary athletes will compete in the Tokyo Olympics. And that apparently is about double what it was last time. In other words, being openly part of the LGBTQ plus community has, or is becoming, very much mainstream. It also suggests that the inclusion of trans women in women's sport is being increasingly normalised by its acceptance at the biggest sporting event in the world. Or, you could try this at home. I did, and it proved true. Try searching in Google Images, straight white couples. See what you get. You actually get anything but straight white couples. The algorithm that they've set up, when you do that search, comes up with gay couples, mixed race couples, black couples, gay couples with children, and the occasional white couple. Really, really interesting. And also some links to sort of pro-gay websites and pro-LGBTQ websites and that kind of stuff. When you search for straight white couples, try it. I'll guarantee, and I've tried it a number of times now just to see if it works, that it happens that way every time. Apparently, it doesn't work quite so readily in other parts of the world. So it doesn't work in Asia, for example. If you do something similar to Asia, you'll get what you ask for, straight white couples. If you do it in America, it's worse in America than here, Australia, England, Europe, you'll get an interesting sort of collection of images in Google Images. So, you know, big tech's on board. They're pushing the agenda. So, critical theory. So these sorts of terms, you know, cisgender, intersectionality, heteronormativity, centering, white fragility, I can explain those later if anyone wants to explore that. All those sorts of terms become part of our cultural lexicon right now. And they're being perpetuated by various things that have occurred in universities. So post-colonial studies, queer theory, critical pedagogy, whiteness studies, critical race theories, all that stuff people have been studying as university courses. And it's all under the banner of critical theory. Now, critical theory began in the 1930s. It was just a method by which you might re-examine history or the social sciences and things of that sort. But it's developed quite a deal since then. It's evolved rather a lot, and it's heavily influenced by postmodernist theory also. And so that's what we're going to sort of think about tonight for just a couple of minutes. Critical theory as it is now, rather than what it once was. In all its iterations, it is principally concerned with hegemonic power and how that power is wielded by dominant groups. In other words, how dominant groups like, so white males, for instance, dominate all others and force them into their particular mould or to adopt their particular worldview or understanding. So according to critical theory, our identity as individuals is inseparable from our group identity. So I might be a black person, or an indigenous person, or a woman, or a disabled person. My personal identity is inseparable from the group identity. Each individual then is seen as either oppressed or an oppressor, depending on their group identity. So groups are normally categorised according to their gender, or their race, or their sexuality, and so on. But the principal oppressors are predominantly white, heterosexual males, in particular, Christians. So you have this division between the oppressor and the oppressed. So if you happen to be here today and you're white, heterosexual, and Christian, you are the most oppressive of all. Again, a couple of examples that have emerged in recent times. And you may have read about these in the paper back in April and March. One was an incident at Parkdale Secondary College, which is in Melbourne, strangely enough. Students at a Melbourne high school have been left shocked after they were made to stand up and be publicly humiliated for being white Christian males. Last Wednesday, which would be mid-April, co-ed school Parkdale Secondary College in the south Melbourne suburb of Wardoliok was visited by a social worker from the local Kingston Council. The social worker spoke about privilege, pronouns, and intersectionality. During the presentation, the social worker was alleged to have asked that the boys who were straight, white, and Christian to stand up in front of their peers. They were then told that they were responsible for being oppressors because of their privilege. And then at Brower College in Warrnambool in March, again from 7 News, male students were purportedly told to apologise to the girls for offensive behaviour on behalf of their gender on Wednesday. Brower principal, Jane Boyle, told 7 News that while the assembly was well-intended, she recognised this part of the assembly was inappropriate. As part of the discussion, boys were asked to stand as a symbolic gesture of apology for the behaviours of their gender that have hurt or offended girls and women. Noted, strangely enough, parents were a bit outraged at all of that. Oppressor groups subjugate oppressed groups, not by use of physical force, but by determining, maintaining, and imposing society's norms, traditions, expectations, and ideologies on minority or marginalised groups. For instance, any attempt to maintain heteronormativity, this is to say that heterosexual understandings are accurate or right, as a societal norm is seen as oppressive by oppressed groups such as the LGBTQ+ community. In modern Western society, as I mentioned before, the most dominant oppressor group is said to be white, heterosexual, or cisgender males, and the power they wield is sometimes labelled white privilege. Third thing, the fundamental moral duty of human beings is to work to liberate oppressed groups. According to one commentator, liberation requires a struggle against discrimination based on race, class, gender, sexual identity, ableism, and age. And so we see a whole lot of very active or determined activism around us these days in various groups. I thought I'd just show quite an interesting little thing here. You might be aware that Hugh Sheridan's come out as a gay man. He calls himself non-binary. What's kind of interesting is he was going to be involved in a production, a musical called Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I won't go any further into what it was about, but he received a letter from the Queer Artists Alliance of Australia who called it offensive that Sheridan had been cast in the lead role as Hedwig Robinson instead of a transgender person. The choice to cast a cisgender male as a transgender character is offensive and damaging to the trans community and continues to cause genuine stress and frustration amongst trans and gender non-conforming performers all across Australia, the group said. The irony, of course, is this. That Hugh Sheridan has come out as a non-binary bisexual human. One of the things just to be aware of when you hear and read stuff is this. It goes goes on and says, 8 months after the star announced they're attracted to both men and women, note there, he's using that as a singular. It's him. It's not a plural. No. It's such a plural term, plural pronoun, but it's referring to him personally. He goes on, the Pactorata stars told the followers, I am still a human, non-binary, bi-me human, but I'm in a monogamous relationship with another human who I love. She said whom I love, but don't worry about that. The interesting thing here, and this is the kind of language to look out for, terms like there, sort of, you know, plural pronouns, but also the word human. And it's interesting, if you follow, you know, get on Facebook or whatever, lots of people from all walks of life are now saying, I'm in love with that human. Or I really, you know, really appreciate that human. They're really buying into this language. Now, whether we need to resist that, that's another issue, whether it's kind of a bit harmless and maybe I'm stretching a little. But it's still interesting to see that kind of terminology has come into our everyday speech, including our social media speech. So again, it's just a kind of an interesting thing that we've come up with, and a point we've reached. Here we have Scarlett Johansson, a picture of her, and you'll find out why in a moment. Critical theory claims that members of oppressed groups have special access to truth because of their lived experience of oppression. In other words, things like my own lived experience trumps reason and logic or evidence. It's seen as at least as valid, if not more valid, than objective evidence or the application of reason to various situations or ideas. Hence, a man can claim to be a woman. Because the logic itself is not actually relevant. The objective evidence isn't the key. It's actually the lived experience I identify as. So on. So just by way of example, Scarlett Johansson was going to star in a film called Rug and Tug. Again, I won't go into what that's about. But there were a whole lot of complaints because it's about a trans man. And so the Guardian reports that there was a whole lot of backlash that says, in response to Johansson's statement, and she decided to withdraw from that role, after all the outcry, GLAAD, as the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, GLAAD President and CEO Sarah Kate Ellis called it a real opportunity for the industry to expand on the authentic transgender portrayals that have been seen on the small screen. Another gay activist and trans activist said, to exhibit the spirit of generosity I earnestly want to see more of, I am going to take Scarlett Johansson at her word, that she listened to feedback, realised that despite her intentions, this was going to cause harm. And I say she wasn't her intention, she intended otherwise, but this woman says it will cause harm and made the right decision to sit down. Well done. Another example is the example of J.K. Rowling. Again, some of you will have read about that. Who also obviously doesn't understand the lived experience of trans women. There was a fundraising sort of thing come out not too long ago where it had a sort of a caption, the punchline was, there was an article about menstrual health and hygiene for people who menstruate. Right? People who menstruate. And so she wrote in a tweet, people who menstruate. I'm sure there used to be a word for these people. Was it, someone help me out? Womben? Wimpen? Womit? Now, she's being sarcastic, obviously, and that may be considered offensive in itself, but still trying to make the point. Now, in response to that tweet, there was a rather predictable torrent of abusive response. I'll offer a couple of examples. I won't, because a number of them have been taken down because they were so offensive, they crossed all bounds, valuable boundaries. But one just says, why do you go out of your way to be turfy? As your trans exclusionary radical feminist. Hey, Joe, it's 2020. Trans men also menstruate. It's time you do some self-reflection and grow a bit, huh? J.K. Rowling then, in response, a few days later, wrote a very gracious essay. I can give you the website so you can read that if you like. I'm not going to go into it, but it's quite lengthy and it's very nuanced. It's quite well structured. It does have a few interesting use of words in it, because she's quoting from some of the blocked tweets. So if you're offended by foul language, it might not be for you, but the argument itself is very well structured and very well worded and very gentle, quite erratic. It was a civil invitation to constructive discussion, but as Carl Truman observed, he said, it will carry little weight because she doesn't have the right to decide who is or isn't a victim. That belongs to the officer class of the dominant ideological framework currently operative. The ideology of the moment finds one of its principal expressions in transgenderism. Individuals who are part of more than one oppressed group experience what's called intersectionality. Their oppression is qualitatively distinct from the oppression of separate groups to which they belong. So that simply means that if you happen to be, say, black, but also poor and also disabled, you have an array of sections, if you like, that you belong to. And the intersection of those various degrees of marginalisation and vulnerability and all the rest of it form one's intersectionality, and each one it has a different set of concerns and, you know, sort of power imbalances. However, it can lead to some things that are totally illogical. For example, if you're a white woman, you're already oppressed by white men. But if you're a white woman and you try to make a comment about, say, some black concern or a concern about disability, then you have no right to say that. That's not part of your lived experience, unless you happen to be white and disabled. So it has, as I say, some interesting ramifications. I'll read one to you from Douglas Murray's book, The Madness of Crowds, and he gives this account of intersectionality in an interesting way. He says, at Wellesley College in 2014, there was a fascinating case where a student arriving at the all-female college announced that she was a genderqueer person who wanted to be known as Timothy and expected people to use male pronouns. Despite having applied as a girl, the other students reportedly had no problem in particular with their male-identifying contemporary. That is, until Timothy announced that he wanted to run for the position of Multicultural Affairs Coordinator. The purpose of this role was to promote a cultural diversity on the university campus. Now, says Murray, it might have been expected that a masculine centre, genderqueer person might have the perfect scorecard for the position, except that students at Wellesley reportedly felt that having Timothy in such a position would perpetuate the patriarchy of the college. A campaign got underway to abstain in the election. One student behind the campaign to abstain said, I thought he'd do a perfectly fine job, but it just felt inappropriate to have a white man there. True story. So, quite interesting. Critical theory functions as a worldview. It offers what worldviews offer. That is, it offers the answers to the big questions of life. Who am I? What's wrong with the world? How do we solve the problem? What's our primary moral duty? And all of those kinds of things. And the way that then works is it sets itself in competition up against other worldviews. So as a meta-narrative, a big explanatory story, it will compete with other meta-narratives, such as Christianity or other religions for dominance. We've seen this in action in the last couple of weeks in Western Australia. The Australian Christian lobby had booked the Albany Entertainment Centre. It was cancelled because the views espoused by ACL over issues such as same-sex marriage and assisted dying are contrary to those held by the WA government. But then as a result of concerted backlash against the decision, the government changed its decision. However, it appears that the WA government is working on further amending the hiring policy in a way that will prevent groups like ACL from hiring the facility in the future. So we have this whole idea that your worldview clashes with my worldview, I've got more power, I'm going to win. So that becomes problematic. So I know I'm at 8:15, but I'll go for about 5 more minutes. So, what do we do? Well, I think first of all, it may be a good idea simply to agree where we can. For instance, surely all Christians oppose racism. Surely all Christians oppose systems that support and promote racism. Now, cultural race theorists understand race to be a social construct, and Christians in the main will agree with that. You know, we're all created in the image of God. And so surely the divisiveness created by race and understandings of differences of ethnicity and so on, you know, we're neither Jew nor Greek. Race is not something that should set us apart. And so we would all oppose the divisiveness of racism and the fact that it is from a Christian perspective, it's an unbiblical anthropology. The Bible's clear that we're all created in the image of God to have an inherent worth just by virtue of being created in the image of God. So any sense of superiority on the basis of race is a consequence of sin. But we should never compromise the conviction that the Bible is the Word of God and is therefore true. So critical theory claims that those in oppressed groups have privileged access to the truth by virtue of their lived experience. Consequently, they claim that appeals to objective evidence and to reason made by dominant or oppressor groups are really an exercise of institutional power. They're not just an exercise of logic and reason, they're an exercise of power. But the Bible's very clear about these things. I think I'll just read one passage. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 12 to 14. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, that we might understand the things freely given us by God. And we impart this in words not taught by human wisdom, but taught by the Spirit, interpreting spiritual truths to those who are spiritual. The natural person does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. So, as Christians, we're fully committed to that idea, the idea that the Word of God functions as the reference point for truth. Anything that contravenes that is automatically and necessarily untrue. We know that truth is actually in the person of Jesus Christ, who said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." I think also we should be charitable. You know, we're called upon to be salt and light. We're called upon to love our neighbours. We're also called upon to love our enemies. I think it's probably possible, maybe probable, that many of those folks who get out there and protest with, say, Black Lives Matter, actually don't know what the organisation truly stands for. They've probably never read its declarations on its own website. But they're there because they're generally concerned about institutional racism. And perhaps we should give people the benefit of the doubt. And it might open up the possibility of conversation. And so there's an array of things we might think about there. You know, Colossians chapter 4, verse 5 says, "Walk in wisdom towards outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that they may know how you ought to, you may know how you ought to answer each person." And a guy named Neil Chenby, who's a fairly well-known commentator on this sort of material, this sort of stuff, says, "When a church demonstrates true neighbour love and fellowship across lines of race and gender, it undermines the idea that critical theory is the only path to human flourishing and gives credibility to the charge that critical theory fails to deliver on its promises." So if we live as a church the way Jesus taught we ought to live, we can actually say there is another way. It's possible we may need to be prepared to suffer. Stephen Shavura is a historian and a fairly well-known commentator these days, believes it's possible, he actually argues it's probable, that Christians will find themselves in legal trouble because they'll have breached some of Australia's current anti-vilification legislation. And we all know that probably the most oppressive of that legislation at the moment is Victoria's Change or Suppression Conversion Practices Prohibition Bill of 2020, which outlaws a whole lot of just normal behaviours, including things like parents praying with their children over their concerns over sexuality and that kind of stuff. Jesus was clear. He said, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." And even Corrie ten Boom's words are instructive. She said, "When a train goes through a tunnel and it gets dark," maybe we're not quite there yet, but maybe that's where we're heading, "don't throw away the ticket and jump off. You sit still and trust the engineer." Something valid, I think, in that. And all moments pass, and this cultural moment will too. I this whole thing at the moment is rather faddish. Fads tend to have peaks and then drop away. I suspect that this will also. People have ultimately recognised that it's both empty and harmful, and I think we'll ultimately respond accordingly. Carl Truman, in my quote earlier, suggested that critical theory and its associated practices will hold sway for a while, maybe even a whole generation, but will ultimately come cropper. And he suggests that one of the reasons, just one, will be financial. He said many who've been rendered sterile through the use of cross-sex hormones and have had life-altering surgery will sue those who advise and sanction such things. Keira Bell, if you've heard of her, has success in the High Court over the against the Tavistock Centre in London, and that's a case in point if you want to check that out later. Truth will prevail because reality demands it. You know, living a fiction is unsustainable. Logic and reason, I suspect, will win out simply because they're fundamental to the nature of reality. Critical theory will eventually be defeated by its inherent irrationality. Whereas the Christian story of redemption is grounded in reality. It tells the truth about God and about people, about what's wrong with the world and what it takes to address that wrong. And I'll finish with this this quote from Blaise Pascal. We all love to read Pensées from time to time, I'm sure, just for fun. But Blaise Pascal said this: what else does this craving, this and this hopelessness proclaim but that there was once in man a true happiness, of which all that now remains is the empty print and trace? This he tries in vain to fill with everything around him, seeking in things that are not there the help he cannot find in those that are. That none can help, since this infinite abyss can be filled only with an infinite and immutable object, in other words, by God himself. So I think ultimately critical theory will be self-defeating because it has no substance, and that the Christian story, which has substance, will rise up once more. So my encouragement tonight is to be informed, to be aware, and to seek opportunity to enter into conversation and to uphold the true, objective Word of God and the offer of redemption that it is. To acknowledge that the true problem is sin and that solution is redemption found in the cross of Christ. The problem is not oppression and the need to liberate.
Thanks for joining us for this presentation from North Pine Baptist Church. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.